We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
State Farm Insurance knows that understanding and investing in our cultural identity is paramount in protecting our future. We know what it's like to go from nothing to something, to wish that we had better financial literacy when we were younger. Luckily, State Farm is here to help with funding programs like Project Ready, which is committed to education achievement and has already awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers to Black and Brown youth since 2021. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
AT&T connects an ode to podcast. Connect the alarm, change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
Moments like my daughter telling me a new joke mean a lot to me. But after being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, or MBC, which is breast cancer that is spread to other parts of the body, they mean even more. I take Ibrance, palbociclib.
Ibrance 125 milligram tablets with an aromatase inhibitor is for adults with HR-positive, HER2-negative MBC as the first hormonal-based therapy. Ask your doctor about Ibrance and visit Ibrance.com. Ibrance may cause low white blood cell counts that may lead to serious infections. Ibrance may cause severe inflammation of the lungs. Both of these can lead to death. Tell your doctor right away if you have new or worsening symptoms, including trouble breathing, shortness of breath, cough, or chest pain. Before taking Ibrance, tell your doctor if you have fever, chills, or other signs of infection, liver or kidney problems, are or plan to become pregnant, or are breastfeeding. Common side effects include low red blood cell and low platelet counts, infections, tiredness, nausea, sore mouth, abnormalities in liver blood tests, diarrhea, hair thinning or loss, vomiting, rash, and loss of appetite.
I was like, ain't everybody at this point? I was like, that man losing bags quick.
For no damn reason.
All his bags.
For no reason.
Just self-inflicted, man.
I'm
self-inflicted.
You.
Now, there's fresh water right there for you.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-mm. This really been the year of self-sabotage. I'm serious, like, for year. Real. Mm.
I think he's the leader in the clubhouse, though.
You what?
For self-sabotage.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Here we go. Oh, yeah.
If you look it up in the dictionary,
oh,
it's
no,
like
no,
his
no,
face.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Here we go, y'all. Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Charlamagne Tha God. We are the Breakfast Club. We got a special guest in the building.
Yes.
The chosen
Jemele
one.
Hill.
She's got a new book out, her Uphill, her mm-hmm. memoir.
That's right.
Great picture, by the way.
Thank you.
How many of these did you have to pick through before you landed on this one?
You know what? And this is going to sound far more salacious than I actually mean it, but that was from a Playboy shoot I did.
What?
Yeah, so.
Well, how'd you do Playboy?
Yeah, because Playboy, read it for the articles. It's very good writing.
Read it for the articles.
It's very good writing in Playboy, everybody.
Hold on, let me see what pictures on the back.
No, but they did a feature on me at some point. I think it was earlier this year. And so the photo shoot, the photographer, I believe his name is Eric Carter. He's based out of L.A. He took some phenomenal photos. So,
wow.
Because during COVID, you know, we couldn't really work out how to, you know, get new photos taken. So I was like, I love these from the Playboy shoot.
Did you play a joke on the husband and be like, hey, I'm doing a shoot with Playboy?
Oh, I totally did. Like, yeah. I was just like, I'm going to be in Playboy. He was like, what?
I think they don't do new pictures anymore.
No,
right?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think it's like a more of a, you know, content oriented.
They've always had good articles in Playboy.
I'm serious. Listen, Alex Haley wrote for Playboy. Okay, so
I don't think anybody ever went to Playboy for the articles.
You telling on yourself right now, but that's okay.
I love the title of the book too. Uphill.
Clever.
I mean, it's a play on your last name, of course, but I mean,
it actually isn't.
It's not.
It's not.
It's not. And it was not my title idea. This was not the original title that I wanted.
What was the original title? The what up, though?
313. That came in third. No, the original title I wanted was Broken Curses, because I talk a lot about my family history, family trauma, and all of that. And my mother, and I'm sure, you know, you guys have heard this before from elders or from your parents or uncles or whatever, but the fact that there are generational curses, and my mother used to talk about, you know, breaking those in our family. And so that's why I wanted to name it Broken Curses. But my publisher, they thought it was a little too negative, that it wasn't uplifting enough. And my book editor, Shannon, shout out to you, Shannon, she came up with that title, Uphill.
Okay. And I said to you, The Chosen One, when we first said it, because honestly, you talk about your mom and the things that she's been through and your whole family, and it's a lot. And so how does she feel about, you know, these stories being told?
So I talked to my mother, but we had numerous conversations about what was going to be in this book. And she knew what I was doing and the journey that I was on in writing it, and knew that I wanted to write it transparently. But honestly, Angela, that was probably the most difficult part, because I was in the unfortunate position of asking my mother about the worst moments of her life. And I tried to save those conversations for last, if you will, so that we could talk about maybe happier things and fun memories, just to kind of not come from a traumatic, you know, perspective. And so it was tough. I mean, my mother told me some stories I did not even know. You know, the story that I tell in the book about
Don't
her.
Don't give too much away.
Okay. But, you know, I guess it's an example of a story. But the story I tell in the book about how one of her low points during her addiction was being, you know, caught in this drug house and having to hide out from drug dealers in that house on the floor, on a rat infested floor. I didn't even know that story until she told me, because that happened when I was in college.
I was so scared with that part. She was underneath those dirty clothes, rats running around.
And she had to stay still.
I was praying to God, and I thought they was going to steal her car while she was inside.
Well, her car, as I tell, did eventually get stolen, you know, and it was nothing she could do about it, but it was where she was at the time that it was stolen and what she was doing.
How did you feel having those conversations with your mom? Because that had to be emotional. I was reading some of that stuff that she went through, and I was like in tears.
It was difficult, but I think for her it was cathartic, because these are traumatic incidents that, you know, during the time after she was, you know, sexually abused, and as I tell in the book, she was the victim of a violent rape. You know, people weren't going to therapy then. Like, that wasn't suggested. And as you know, Charlamagne, from your work in mental health in our community, that was something we didn't do. So imagine going through all of that with no therapy. And that's why, as I discuss in the book, she was going through very severe PTSD and did not know it, because that wasn't a term then that we even were familiar with. And so, those were difficult conversations. But I think at the end of them, it was really healing for both of us, you know, to be honest. Like, I certainly knew about the trauma she experienced, but her going into detail, it gives me a better and more enriched perspective about who she is.
Yeah, I feel like it allowed you to give her more grace.
Yeah, and listen, people have been asking me about what I want people to take away from this book. It's a few things, but one of the most important things is that I want people to know you should talk to your people while they're here, right? Like, absolutely. Your mothers, your aunties, your father, whoever in your family, find out about them, because usually, like, especially your relatives and especially your parents, they lived the whole life.
That's right.
Before you even got here.
That's right.
And writing this book, it really made me miss my grandmother, who died in 2010, because I realized I didn't ask her nearly as much about her life as I should have. You know, even I know it's hard sometimes for parents and grandparents to share, you know, traumatic moments or their failures or disappointments, but it helps you see them as full people. And maybe that does allow you to give them more grace with some of the decisions they made, and even in some respects to how they've treated you.
I was going to ask, did you understand more after talking to your mom and writing this book? Because, you know, even for myself, I didn't really understand until I had kids. And then when I had kids and I'm living my own life, I'm like, that's why my dad did that. That's why my mom acted that way. But, you know, at during the time, I don't want to say I hated them, but you hated what they were doing.
Right.
But now it's like, damn, I understand. So did you understand more and were able to?
You know what I understood more is why, even in present day, she lives with so much regret. We had an interesting conversation recently about that because I forgave my mother for this a long time ago. I've let this go because I think as a kid, you know, it was different because her trauma was something I had to navigate around. So it felt like my childhood was being stolen from me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you carry some resentment for that. And so I let that go. I forgave her, encouraged her as she was turning her life around. You know, my mother, I mean, she's got her master's now. You know, she got her bachelor's, master's. Mm-hmm. You know, she out-educated me, mm-hmm. which I'm very, very proud that she did that. And she went back to school in her 50s. Okay. And so, you know, this has really been a remarkable turnaround for her. But yeah, I mean, once I let all of that stuff, you know, go, I think I was good with it. But I think she still struggles to forgive herself because she feels like she missed so much. But the thing is, and it's something I wrote in the book, is that my mother was there for everything.
Right.
Like, even though, you know, she had a severe addiction, I didn't have one of those stories where my mom was missing for days, like, mm-hmm. or didn't feed me, or the lights was cut off.
And she was very protective of you.
Correct.
Still, no matter what.
No matter what. Mm-hmm. So, like, that wasn't my story necessarily, because I know some people who are the child of addicts, they do have that story. Mm-hmm. But she was there, but she wasn't always present. Gotcha. You know what I mean? And so I think because she was trying to, figure out how to come out of all the darkness she was in, I had to figure out ways to navigate around her abuse, her drug abuse. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't know what mood you're going to be in. I don't know what person I'm getting today. Mm-hmm. I don't know when I come home what dynamic I'm going to find. And so that for me was where the resentment was coming from, is feeling like, man, I got to do all this. You know, I'm trying to be a kid, and mm-hmm. it's all this seriousness and darkness kind of around us. And so I think once I really talked to her about it, and we've talked throughout the years, but it definitely helped me to understand a lot of the decisions she made.
Mm-hmm. Watching what she went through, did it like scare you away from drugs and alcohol?
Oh, I mean, you know, like, I've never, ever tried hard drugs in my life. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody who's done any of that. I mean, that I know of. Mm-hmm. I'm not on that scene. I'm not about that. I mean, I smoked a little weed like here and there. Mm-hmm. May have taken an edible or two. Like, like, that's about it. Mm-hmm. And I do like tequila. But knowing mm-hmm. the history of addiction in my family has definitely made me more cognizant of some things.
Mm-hmm. Did your mom forgive her mother? Did she have that opportunity to have those conversations?
So they didn't get to the best place. There was always unconditional love. My mother loved my grandmother fiercely. But when my grandmother made the decision not to believe her about the abuse my mother suffered at the hands of her brother, it was a fracture in their relationship that never healed. Mm. And unfortunately, even when my grandmother died, like, my mother was her caretaker. You know, like, she, regardless of whatever state their relationship was in the moment, my mother was never going to abandon and stop loving my grandmother. And my grandmother definitely loved her, but she herself was somebody who, you know, we used to have conversations about this. Like, she used to tell me, like, she didn't really want kids. And she felt, she was a very smart woman. You know, and she really wanted a career, like the kind of career I had, not necessarily a journalist, but she wanted a career. She wanted to travel the world, all these things. And she was born in 1925. And so education for Black women was not a thing in terms of people thinking that they should be educated or that there was value in that. As you know, during those times, I mean, everything that a woman wanted to get financially or any upward mobility came through marriage. Mm-hmm. And so she was married 3 times. And, you know, she had her 3 kids, but she was just in many ways trapped in a life she didn't feel like she chose. And I think because of that, she wasn't the best parent to my mother and to, you know, my uncle that she could have been. She struggled a lot. They got evicted a lot. My grandmother was a functional alcoholic. Like, they had some trauma, some real issues. And so she was a great grandmother to me, and my mother would still call her a great mother despite all the, you know, troubles that they went through. But I just think that My mother never got the grandparent I got.
Right.
You know?
And I was asking, is there anything that you decided not to put in the book? That you was like, you know what, let's leave this out, or I'm going to take this out, or other family members are not going to like this.
I know y'all like to hear the inside. Y'all know, I know people keep it real over here in the tea. There was one thing, I cannot tell y'all what it was. Me and my mother got into an enormous argument about this. And the thing is that it was the only thing in the book she was, because she got an early copy, like an advanced reader copy, where you could still edit and change things. And she was hot about it. And we had it out. But the funny thing was, after our argument, she told, you know, some of her friends about it. And they told her she was tripping. And I had a time to think about it, reflect on it. I talked to my husband about it. And, you know, the thing when you write a memoir, you're writing about people who really exist. And so you have to be careful, truthful, but careful. Right. You know what I'm saying? So that's why when I talk about the abortion I had, I did not use the person's real name, because I don't know if they've told that story. I don't know if his people know or what state that's in, and I didn't want to take away that opportunity from him to tell his story his own way. So with my mother, I had to think about the fact that, what is this relationship going to look like after this book? And while I didn't anticipate my mother would stop talking to me or that, but it could be a wedge issue. And this is in print, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, forever.
It's forever, right? So I had to really think about, do I really want to do this?
I can't imagine what it could be, because there is so much that
I'll tell y'all off here. I'll tell y'all off.
Even, look, your journal, you discussed that part.
Yeah, oh, Jesus.
Man, and for parents, let me ask the guys in the room, because y'all have kids, would you read your daughter's journal if you saw it laying around?
I would tell my wife to read it.
You would?
Really? Because you don't want to read it?
Yeah, and I don't want to read it, but I do think, I probably would read it. Only because, like, I just feel like there's certain things
that
we should know as parents. You know what I mean?
I would definitely read it.
You would definitely read it? And I would, the only reason I say yes, because I've gone through the phone.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
And when but
I
went that's through, not the same, though.
Yes, it is. Nowadays,
it's like your deepest,
exactly,
innermost thoughts.
They could not be true things. It could be just you.
It could be you
it's
just
like therapy.
Like venting.
It's like eavesdropping on a therapy session.
But it could be something where, you know, something's bothering you that you don't talk about.
That's
and you're thinking about committing suicide or hurting yourself or hurting somebody. So if I can stop that, and maybe you hate me, but hopefully you love me later on because I was able to stop that. Now, if it's something else, I mind my business and act like I didn't read it. But if it's something where you could have, you know, hurt yourself, hurt somebody else, hurt a classmate.
Well, how do you look at it, Jamil?
Obviously, I disagree, and I got my ass whooped because of it, okay? And that was the thing, is that because of all the, you know, tumultuousness in our life, that I needed some place to vent. You know, I couldn't vent to my grandmother, because my grandmother, then that causes friction between her and my mother. I was too embarrassed to vent to my friends and let them in on the issues. Not like I could pick a teacher, because that's a double ass whooping coming, right?
You didn't have therapy back then.
Didn't have therapy. Yeah. So my journal was literally that. And so there is, I think that might be, that's a top three frightening moment of my life. When you come home and your mother is sitting there with
the
your journal open.
Reading it.
Reading it.
Is what you think of me?
Exactly. I mean, that woman, I was like, I was like, you tried to kill me, my straight up.
When she read the advanced copy of the book, did it bring you back to that moment?
It was triggering writing it. I was just like, okay, because that's the worst ass whooping she ever gave me in my life. Like, there's nothing that comes
close. That was abuse.
It was. And then she, you know, years later, she was like, you know you didn't deserve them whoopings. Well, can you go back in time and unwhoop me? Can you do this? But, you know, that was one of our actually most fun conversations, because there were details of that I did not remember. And I was like, that don't really sound like me. Because she told me that, one, she was sitting there with my journal, and then she was like, let's talk about this in the basement. I was like, oh shit, I'm never coming back. Like,
in the basement.
And she said, that's when I told her that I wanted to go live with my father. I was like, what would possess me to say that?
Right. Yeah, that's because, like, you was about to get. You gotta get out the house.
And that's why she bagged up all my shit, and took me right to his job and was like, she's all yours now. And I was like, this was a grave mistake on my part.
This man.
Yeah. I was able to keep a journal later as an adult. And I actually had an ex who read my journal too. And woo.
You need better hiding spots. That's what you
need. I mean, people need to not be nosy. How about that?
But I guess it's your child. I understand what they said as far as.
But
like,
your man? Oh,
no,
hell
not your
no.
Man. Definitely not. Hell you know no. What, man? And what your book sparked a conversation that I had recently. Somebody told me, a man, and I was thinking about survival and like for women, and I saw like with your mom stories of just who she was with was sometimes just for survival. Like
right.
Who can financially
correct.
Provide and take care of things. Somebody said to me the other day, man, I wish I had money and could handle my business so I could date who I want to date. And I thought about that because, you know, but there's people who end up in situations where it's like, this is a good provider. I have a family, I have children, and therefore this is a smart decision for me to be with this person. And that's something your mom actually had to do also.
Yeah, I mean, and she's very practical. Mm-hmm. And so to her, those were the qualifications she was looking for in the being with somebody, especially at a certain stage in life. Like her first marriage, my first stepfather, as I love to say to my mother, just to mess with her, like stepfather number one. She did that one for love, mm-hmm. right? That was like purely for love. But I think after that, and certainly with some of the circumstances in our life, there was a practicality that she thought, you know, it didn't make sense to her to be with a man who could not provide for you financially. I mean, she's very old school in that way. And, you know, even as my profile expanded and, you know, she would give me dating advice, like, I understand that, you know, your salary is published, whether true or not. And so she was, one of her biggest concerns is that some man would want to be with me just because, you know, of my money. And, you know, I told her, like, we have a totally different kind of viewpoint of those things. I was like, you know, when I get married, I want to do it for love. Right. That's not to say that financial considerations are not a part of this. Mm-hmm. You know, you do have to have some common sense with it. But that can't be the provision can't be the basis necessarily of mm-hmm. our marriage, if that makes sense, because mm-hmm. it's more than just financial things that mm-hmm. you need from a person. And, you know, there's emotional security that you need from that person as well. Trust, nurturing, commitment, like all those other things that really don't have anything, you know, to do with money. That's why I'm always like, I always laugh because people, this is obviously before I got married, they're always surprised. They were always surprised that I wasn't, you know, dating like some athlete or somebody else. I was like, that has never been, that's never been my style.
But that's the point, is that you are financially able to be in love, because for some women, they're like, I got to be practical.
Yeah, no. And
to get to a space financially where you're like, I can do what I want.
But it's funny, though, because I wish, you know, for my mother that, like, she was a little less practical and was more, you know, that's not to say that she was incapable of the loving aspect of a relationship, but it is to say that I think, you know, because of so much was robbed from her,
right.
you know, from a physical standpoint, I do think it was much harder for her to really trust any man. Mm-hmm. And so to her, the provision part, like, okay, this is a tangible that I can see, that I can rely on. That's why I think that had such a high importance for her.
How important, because I don't think we talk about this enough, how important is picking the right partner, the right mate? How important is that to breaking generational curses?
Oh, I think it's a huge part of it. I mean, listen, between my mother, my grandmother, and my great aunt, who also is no longer living, they were married 8 times.
Wow.
Okay. 8 times.
Wow.
And, you know, there were certainly some successful marriages in my family. I did not see a lot of them growing up, because even the people that were together, you know, it was like, okay, come on. You know, mm-hmm. like it was definitely some turbulence that was there. And for a long time, I did not want to get married. And that was because seeing how those relationships created some brokenness in them. And I was like, I don't want any part of that. If that's what that's supposed to look like, I'm good. And that's why I'm so thankful that I got married when I did, like when I was into my 40s already. Because by that time, having some lived experience, being at a point where I didn't need to get married, certainly, the only way I was going to get married if I truly wanted to be with that person. And so when I met my husband in 2014, you know, I wasn't looking.
What did you
meet? We met at homecoming at Michigan State. You know, I know that of course, now we're in like HBCU homecoming
season
right now. And it's like, look, at PWIs, the black people do our thing too, all right? You know, I'm not saying it's as lit as Hampton. I'm not saying that envy, all right? I get it. It is a little different, all right? But we do all right. And so I was there in Michigan State as the Grand Marshal of the Homecoming Parade. Mm-hmm. And I was at the Black Alumni tailgate.
Okay.
Okay, MSU Black Alumni, MSU BA, shout out. I was there and I was actually talking to a former student of mine, because when I worked in Detroit at the Free Press, I co-taught a sports writing class at Michigan State. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the students that was in my class. And so I'm talking to him and I see this like fine dude like kind of roll up. I was like, okay. I was like, I don't know what's happening there, but I'm liking the energy. And we were just like flirting and going back and forth, but we never exchanged numbers. Because, you know, the student I was talking to knew my husband. They were good friends. And later on that night at the Black Alumni party that they have during homecoming weekend, DJed by MC Light, like I'll never forget, I saw him at the party. And I was like, what are the odds that you see the fine guy that you've never seen before? And I've been coming to homecoming for a couple years, that you see him again. Must be a sign.
The black party? Yeah. Probably high.
Well, but I had been going to homecoming for the last couple of years, mm-hmm. going to all the black events. I'd never seen him.
Oh, okay.
Right? And once we got to talking, I mean, like he, at my home church growing up is right in his neighborhood. All my people lived in the side of Detroit that he lived on. And it was a miracle. We have never run into each other.
Wow.
And even though he went to Michigan State, he's 5 years younger than me. So we weren't there at the same time, but gotcha. We had a lot of like connections. So he came over to talk to me. He got my number.
Okay.
And he called me the next day, which a lot of dudes don't do anymore. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like calling you right away.
Not a text, but a phone call.
A phone call. Mm-hmm. That was the other thing that was impressive. Also impressive, I actually answered it.
Wow.
Right? I was like, hello, you know? And so, and the rest was kind of history, as they say. And we had our first date a couple weeks later. It just so happened I was going to Orange County in California for a work conference for ESPN. And then his company happens to be headquartered in Orange County, and he was going to be there
wow.
for business.
He was going to be there regardless.
God,
wow.
God did.
Wow. No,
I got a meeting out there. It just so happened.
It just so what? You going there too? No, we were just talking on the phone, and he was like, wait a minute, I'm going to be there too. And so he came over to my hotel, and we hung out, had some drinks, and, you know, he stayed overnight. Nothing happened. Let me just say this, because mm-hmm. I see where y'all mind is going.
No.
Nothing happened. And I thought, like, when he...
Y'all didn't even kiss?
Wait, what?
When he said nothing happened, he
mean,
like,
did y'all kiss?
I mean,
well,
yeah,
you said
matter.
Nothing happened.
Well, you're right.
Whatever
let me clarify. No sex happened.
Okay?
Okay? All right? And, yeah, we did kiss, mm-hmm. but, you know, we just slept. And the next day I thought, man, as soon as daylight hit, this dude gonna be out of here. Mm-hmm. And but he wasn't.
He's never left since.
He was like, let's go to breakfast.
I find it hilarious that he's out there recording this. Like, you haven't heard this story a million times. Like, you haven't read the book. Like, you haven't heard the audible. Like,
he's smiling.
He's like,
yeah.
It never gets old.
See? I know, right?
I went to breakfast.
Yeah, you know, I think he just wanted to see if I tell some various, you know, some differing version of what he tells, you know, or whatever. He puts a little more sauce on when we first met than I do, but that is the truthful version of what happened.
Now, you talk about in the book about your experiences growing up in Detroit, but what I want to know is how hard is it to let go of the Detroit in you when you're in these corporate environments? How much Detroit do you need?
How many times do you go, what up, doe?
Well, of course, when I see somebody from Detroit, you know, that's, as you know, Jalen Rose worked at ESPN. We see each other. We like, what up, though, right? Okay. You know what? The Detroit in me will never leave. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
That's right.
That doesn't mean that you're in meetings and corporate environments having to cuss people out or do anything like that. But, you know, you let people know you have a boundary and that you expect to be respected. And I think the parts of Detroit that are in me are parts that have just done wondrous things for my life. You know, Detroit, Angela knows this, Detroit is a tough city. It's a resilient city. it's also a city where, you know, we take a lot of pride in being from there. Don't nobody put on for Detroit like people from Detroit.
Y'all lingo.
We got our, yes, exactly. We got our dance, little boss up action, like we, all of that. Yeah, that's a part of who we are. And so that's why in my social media bio, I say that, you know, I was raised in Detroit, grew up in Michigan State. Like Detroit is going to always run hot and heavy through my blood.
And also a little flossy all the time. That aspect of being
the fact that we wear meat coats to the movies, like, oh, now you'll never take the Detroit
and
out
the
of
education
me.
That you got there, I think, was incredible. Just to hear, because I feel like that shaped a lot of who you are today. Just being from there, but also the school that you went to, and then the mentors, or people that actually encouraged you to try different things, because a lot of kids don't have that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there were so many pivotal points in my life where just a seed planted by somebody, just a word that got me to the next step that I was supposed to get to, that encouraged me to kind of keep going. And, you know, Detroit, I was largely, with the exception of 2 or 3 years, a public high school, a public education student. You know, I went to public elementary school. I went to a public middle school, you know, Bobian Middle School. Went to Mumford. That's where I graduated from high school. And it's another reason why public education is very important to me. I was lucky because Detroit gave me a firm sense of my identity. You know, it was a city, I think now it might currently be the blackest city in America because it's, what, 85% black. When I was growing up, it was over 1 million people lived in Detroit. It was like 90% black. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have to have First Fridays in Detroit. It was called going to the grocery store. You saw black people everywhere, you know, you went.
Downtown a little different.
You know, yeah, now it is. Yeah. But back then it wasn't like that. It was still ours, if you know what I mean. And so having black teachers, having black male teachers throughout my entire, you know, schooling, like those were important identity moments. You know, I didn't have to go out of my way to learn about black history. My teachers just taught it. It was just a part of the curriculum. You know, I took African-American history classes at Mumford.
Right.
So it was just like that was nothing new. And so to go from that environment and then to go to Michigan State, you know, 40,000 students, 80% of them white, probably more than that. It was like quite a culture shock for me. But I was so glad to have had that experience of growing up in Detroit because that allowed me to always have pride in my identity and, you know, to kind of carry that with me wherever I went. You know, that's why I laugh, and I'm sure, Envy, you probably get this, when people say going to a HBCU is not the real world. I was like, no, you need to be rooted in who you are because whatever environment you step into, you cannot let it change who you are or let them tell you who you are.
Well, Envy's Dominican, so it's,
I am not Dominican.
And
I'm
even
black.
Going to Michigan State, you weren't even fathoming that you could have white roommates.
No, I mean, it was wild because, but it was some of the racial conversations we used to have them. Good God, thank God. Nobody had a phone because they would be like, what? But, you know, my suite mates at the time, they were from Sterling Heights, Michigan. And we used to call it growing up Sterling Whites, right? Because it was that white, right? And, you know, they had no idea who Malcolm X was.
Wow.
They were like, we get Martin Luther King Jr.'s, we get a day off for that? They had no idea. Like, they were like, I think we were at school. I was like, that can't be the case. It's a national holiday. They just didn't know. They didn't have any exposure to black people outside of listening to The Chronic. Like, they really didn't. Wow. Like, they didn't know anything. And so, but in fairness, I didn't know a whole lot about white people either. Obviously, I knew way more history about white people than they knew about, you know, black people. But in terms of just being around white people, I didn't have that much experience with that. So it was great. And we're still friends to this day that we were able to, you know, learn from each other. But, you know, there was some Michigan State, like, I mean, that was a place where, you know, I really came into my own and grew up. But in terms of, you know, having just real up close experiences with racism, that all, you know, a lot of that started and happened there.
Can you talk about, you know, you talk about what your mother taught you about black conservatives.
About my article in The Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my mother is, she has a deep sense of her faith. She's a Christian and, or a believer, you know, as she likes to put it. And because of her religious background, or because of her faith, I won't use the term religion, you know, she is certain conservative principles that she has. Now, some of these principles are outside of faith. because, you know, the one thing that's hilarious to me about, you know, Republicans is that they want to always label black people liberal. And y'all know, in having conversations, especially with some elders, the black people,
right,
like, they conservative as hell.
Or from the South.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially those from the South. And so the black people don't have a problem with conservatives. We got a problem with racism.
That's right.
Those are totally, you know, different things. And so my mother, you know, she's old school. And especially, you know, with her being a believer, she does not believe in abortion. And there's other ideals that she has that we clash on, because clearly that's not where I'm coming from. And but I think her being that way has really given me insight about conservatives, particularly those that tie it to their Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's informed a lot of my opinions and even how I write about those issues when I'm attacking conservatives usually.
But this era, this Trump conservative is totally different than the ones from back in the day, I think.
It's definitely different. But, you know, as I write about in the book, there were things about Trump that appealed to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that seems strange to say about, you know, a 60-something-year-old black woman from Detroit, but she liked the macho shit. I mean, she liked the tough talk and the whole generation is soft. Like, that fed right into a lot of the things that she believes,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? And she also watched him on The Apprentice, too. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, so I think while these Trump conservatives are markedly different, markedly more dangerous, there are some core principles they have that, frankly, Republicans have always had.
Right.
He didn't invent a lot of the things that he's done. He perfected some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you look back at Ronald Reagan's presidency, you see a lot of similarities.
Yeah, he evokes a lot of those talking points.
He totally does.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to touch on a few things without telling everything, but Chapter 8, Free Press Don't Raise No Punks. Expound on that a little bit.
So that title came from a very fun night that I had when I was covering Michigan State basketball. They had just beaten Kentucky in the Elite Eight and were on their way to their first Final Four since Magic took them in 79. So this is back in 1999. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, Michigan State, because they were good, they had a lot of media coverage, a lot of Detroit media outlets and Michigan media outlets that were following them. And so after the game, you know we headed to the Final Four. So we all went out to just hang out, get some drinks. And somehow we just started doing tequila shot after tequila shot after tequila shot. And I might have been 4 or 5 in easy. And somebody was like, are we doing one more round? And most people tapped out. I was like, I ain't tapping out. Free Press Don't Raise No Punks. And they never let me forget that. So for years when I was on the beat, man, every time I ran into another reporter who was there that night, they'd be like, Free Press Don't Raise No Punks. I was like, I can't stand y'all. So that is where that title came from.
Yeah, it's interesting that you didn't realize your voice, how it could be so polarizing for certain people, right? To write an article and then to get responses where people are even threatening you.
Yeah.
And at such a young age, too.
No, I mean, that started, like, I started getting hate mail back at Michigan State. I mean, the first time I was called a nigger was at Michigan State,
mm-hmm.
right? And unfortunately, because I did have that experience there, had it at the Free Press, every place I worked, Orlando, Raleigh, I was called a racial slur. Every place. I was either told to, you know, I was either called a racial slur, told to go back to Africa, or go write for Cosmo. It was going to be one of those three.
Wow.
And so,
why Cosmo?
Woman's magazine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was like,
huh? I was like,
yeah, that's okay. You wouldn't even think about the gender. You were like, that's weak. No, so every time I had been told that. And so by the time it started happening at ESPN, and especially after what I said about Donald Trump, I had already been through it.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't nearly effective. The problem is with the Trump thing, like, that took it to a whole new level. You know, I had certainly faced hate before in my career and even gotten a couple death threats. That was different, you know. And when I was at ESPN and that happened, it was just like the mobs of mail. Like, you know, you real racist when you take the time out to write somebody a letter,
mm-hmm.
calling them a nigger. among many other things. I was like, damn, that took, you had to put a stamp on this. Yeah, go to the post.
Tweet.
Like, right, I can see if you fire up a tweet or a Facebook message. Like, that's fast.
That's
like,
old school, though. That's
you know what I'm saying?
School.
That's that old school racism. Mm-hmm. Man.
They probably ain't got no Wi-Fi in them backwoods. That's probably what it was.
They like, they took time out of their day to make sure they got that
stamp. I feel like you had to hold back talking about everything at ESPN, too.
What, in the book?
Yeah.
You know what? There was, I don't think I held back, but I think there are parts of that story that, you know, frankly, didn't really go with the whole narrative of what I, there's a whole lot of incidents I could have certainly talked about, but it's like, it just didn't make sense in terms of the storytelling rhythm I wanted to go. Plus, you know, ESPN was a chapter in my life. It wasn't my whole life.
Right.
And I realized that a lot of people may buy this memoir because they looking for the ESPN dirt and gossip. I was honest. I'm sure there are some people at ESPN that probably don't like some of the things that I put in there. But it is what it is.
You were very honest. You said you were embarrassed sitting there while they were, he was reading verbatim what you said.
Oh, man. Talking about the former president of ESPN, John Skipper, who is still a friend of mine. You know, we went through a rough period after the Donald Trump incident. And, you know, as I write about, the most disappointing part about all of that, it wasn't what the president said. It wasn't the reaction. It wasn't the death threat. The most disappointing part of that was that when he called me out, when the White House said that I should be fired, ESPN did not have my back.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Because there's a code in journalism, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And every newspaper I ever worked for, I fully believe that if that happened while I was at that paper, they would have put out a statement right away saying, uh-uh. Now, you may not like what she said, but she one of us. Because that's the whole, that's the whole tenet of a free press, right? It's like, you're supposed to be protected from government, you know, persecution. And there's so many examples in the history of journalism of where newspapers and outlets have done exactly that. Like when City Hall comes after your reporter, it's understood you got your reporters back. And when ESPN didn't do that and just let me twist and let me fry, I was mad. I was disappointed. Honestly, I was hurt. I had been there 11 years at that point. I'm like, we got to be better than this. And one of the, you know, one of the healing aspects of my relationship with Skipper, like when we met the day before I was coming off suspension and we went to have breakfast, he apologized to me then and said he was sorry. He said if there was one regret he had, it was that he should have said something after Trump or former press secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said something about me.
Did he tell you the truth, too, about how, you know, a lot of those network execs were afraid that Trump wouldn't clear the Fox-Disney merger?
No, he actually didn't.
Oh, okay.
He didn't tell me that. Is that like the equivalent of Bill Cosby was buying NBC? Or?
No, that was actually true. Like people were afraid that he wasn't going to approve the merger between Fox Disney. I forgot who else it was.
Well, I think a part of it, you know, at that point, if y'all remember in 2017 when, you know, those tweets happened and I got in the crosshairs of the president, ESPN was at a very interesting juncture. Mm-hmm. Like they were being called too political. Mm-hmm. Too left, liberal leaning, and, you know, which I thought in many ways was just coded racism because suddenly you see a new emergence of faces at ESPN. You know, you had Stephen A. Smith becoming the face of the network. You had me. You had Michael Smith. You had Bomani Jones. All these Sarah Spain, Kate Fagan, like all these different new diverse voices that were that had major platforms. You know, Dan Le Batard. So suddenly you see a mix up in terms of what the talent looks like at ESPN, and then all of a sudden they're too political and too liberal. You know, because people, often, white America, just our presence to them is political. Our presence to them is liberal. We're reminding them of something just by sitting here. We could say nothing political at all, and they would swear we were political. So that's why I used to get so pissed when Mike and I were doing SportsCenter and they used to call our show political. We never talked about politics. They acted like when they turned to SportsCenter, we were breaking down immigration reform. Mm-hmm. That, like, never happened. And we got sick of talking about Colin Kaepernick, not because his story was important, but we had producers that every time a quarterback was signed would come running at us like, y'all want to talk about Colin Kaepernick? I was like, no. Mm-hmm. We don't. Like, we said what we said. Mm-hmm. Like, it's already been established that the NFL is not going to let him back into playing football. And so people were trying to create a narrative around our show just because we were our black ass selves on TV. And that was, you know, really a difficult period to go through as you're trying to get a new show off the ground, trying to find your footing. And all of this noise and narrative is around the show about it not being too political and Mike and I are racist, and they started calling us woke center. Like that was some bullshit. Like it really was.
I find it hilarious that ESPN had to turn right back around though, and they couldn't run from the fact that there was an intersectionality between politics, social issues, and sports.
Yeah, I mean it's just. I think they went through a period of time where they just didn't have the stomach for the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it came to me and our show, that when you had all these right-wing publications, media outlets writing about us all the time, you know, whenever we discussed anything that was, you know, remotely close to race or, you know, anything that came up within the, you know, the realm of sports, they just didn't want any part of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, their relationship with the NFL was a little tenuous. And so I think they kind of took a cowardly way out for a little while. And so when they hired, you know, our friend Angela Rye, and they seemed to be ready to reengage in those conversations, particularly after George Floyd, I was mostly happy for my former colleagues, because I know that a lot of them had a lot of things they wanted to say and didn't feel the comfort or safety to say them. And seeing the company kind of reverse course a little bit, I think, was helpful for them so that they could join the dialogue.
Mm. Now, before you get about here, we got to ask a couple of sports questions, if you don't mind.
Oh, real quick, one more thing about the book then. Chapter 5, you pay homage to Judy Blume with that title. Are you there, guys? It's me, Judy.
You got it, see?
Absolutely.
You know, Beverly Cleary.
And Judy Blume.
Judy Blume got me through.
Man.
Y'all don't know.
Deanie,
me both.
Deanie.
Oh, Deanie.
She has school. That's how I learned about
love scoliosis. Love Deanie, right? You know, but shoot, the way people are acting about this book banner, and Judy Blume might be banned right now. I have no idea. God is Me, Margaret might not be a thing anymore. You know?
I always feel like young adult novels are so important, too.
Yeah, no.
Because you know, I think about all the things. I even used to read them Sweet Valley High books.
I used to read Sweet Valley High, too. Choose Your Own Adventure. Like,
oh, I love
like,
Choose Your Own.
I used to love Choose Your Own Adventure. Like, those are...
You remember when Netflix did that Black Mirror episode, it was Choose Your Own Adventure?
I have never seen Black Mirror.
Really?
No.
They got a Choose Your Own Adventure Black Mirror.
No way.
Yes, where it's interactive. Like, that shit is great.
All right, I got to peep that.
Now, my sports question.
Oh, God.
Draymond Green, Jordan Poole. Draymond Green punches him in the face. Can Jordan Poole stay there and play comfortably there?
I think this was evident before this... incident, just because the state that Golden State is in terms of their finances. I mean, that's a hella check they're going to have to write in luxury taxes alone if they decide to re-sign Draymond, give him a new deal, rather. And so I think it was probably trending toward him not being there anyway.
Mm.
And, you know, I know Draymond, good dude. I know people have polarizing opinions about him. That was a bad moment, obviously. Mm. Now, the only thing I... debated with people who called it a sucker punch.
No,
I don't
not
know.
No damn sucker
that
punch.
Was not a sucker punch, no. Right? Like, it's just, there's an aggressive moment that's happening, and I know that's your teammate, and people are like, oh, but, you know, he should have recognized that's his teammate, and he wasn't expecting a punch. Have you seen family members fight? Mm-hmm. Yes. I certainly have, right? Mm-hmm. So, I just think that was a really bad moment for him. I think he recognizes that. I think he is honestly remorseful, but I don't see them coexisting.
Jordan Poole should have ducked, because here's the thing. If you push somebody that hard, you got to expect something in return.
Something is coming back.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. This is not Jordan Poole's fault at all. But I think because of the finances, he won't be there.
They're repeating this year, though. They are repeating this year.
Yeah. I was on the fence at first because I was like, I don't know, because this might be one of those. No. Oh, no, because of this incident. Because this might want to be one of those things that, like, early in the season, there's certainly, you know, some momentum that you have now. But the season drags on. You know, I don't know. I don't know how they respond and are able to play when you have that big of a issue that's kind of right there. But these guys are veterans. I think they're hungry. I think they kind of know it's their last stand.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect them to repeat as well.
Ben Simmons, Russell Westbrook.
What's the question?
Ben Simmons. I mean, was it a good team?
Who's better? Is that what we're doing? You know, it's a messy image.
What's the one word that comes to your mind when you think Ben Simmons, Russell Westbrook?
Miss.
Right?
But, you know, honestly, I feel really bad for Russell Westbrook because, you know, especially...
You just gonna jump over Ben Simmons' baguette.
No. I mean, Ben Simmons, I think he's not as bad as people think, you know, and what you hate to see is when you look at an athlete and you could tell psychologically something's going on.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And it's just, it feels like criticizing him And this is not to say that he doesn't deserve, you know, some criticism, but it just feels like he's mentally worn out. That's what he seems like to me. Russell Westbrook is the same thing.
Really?
Is that because Russell is clearly frustrated. Russell doesn't want to play this shitty. Like, he doesn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. But now, and this is the gift and curse of playing with LeBron. It's never going to be LeBron's fault. I'm not saying it is, but the people that play around LeBron, remember how the people used to be on Chris Bosh all mm-hmm. the time? Like, it's always somebody that when they play with him, that becomes the target for all the frustration over, you know, losing, over all of this, and it's Russell Westbrook. They have made him the villain of the team. And I'm not talking about the organization itself, but fans, you know? And he's clearly struggling. I kind of agree with what Charles Barkley said. I don't really see the joy in his game like I used to. Like, he's certainly still a great athlete, but you'd be crazy not to think it's not mentally wearing on him, that he's not thinking about this every time he takes a shot. The fact that the fans are booing him. It reminds me of when Josh Smith played in Atlanta, and every time he took a three-pointer, the crowd be like, no! It's like, I feel like I hear that every time Russell, like, takes a shot. Like, people are mad,
yeah.
Right? And so to play like that in your hometown, mm-hmm. right? And that's the vibe? You can't tell me that mentally, that wouldn't break you a little bit.
That's interesting, because I feel like Ben is mental and Russ is just physical. Like, Russ still got that energy and confidence. I just don't know if he's physically able to play the way he used to.
I mean, I sense certainly the energy. I don't mean to make it sound like he's melanin in or like that, but it's like a joy that comes to playing with basketball. Mm. And it doesn't feel like he is playing with a lot of joy.
Mm.
That's all. No Cowboy questions? I thought I was going
to
get some.
We're going to the Super Bowl. I don't need you to tell me that we're going to the Super Bowl.
Let's go ahead. What do you think about my New York Giants?
I think the Giants look good. You know, I mean, I'm sure Daniel Jones is thinking about how he got slandered when they made that pick. And
the
now,
last couple of years he got slandered.
Definitely last couple of years, but they didn't have as good of a team, I think, as they have now. Love Brian Daboll. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, definitely one of those coaches I've been watching for a while. And so he felt like he would be a good fit for this team. So, look, New York football, Jets and Giants. You know, Robert Saleh, like, he was a 49ers fan. He was...
How'd that happen, by the way? I always wonder about that. How did Jamel Hill end up a 49ers fan?
Well, as
you... Was she going to be a Lions fan?
Yeah.
Listen, I value my mental health. Isn't that what... That's what you talk about, Char, all the time, right? It's like, mental health is wealth. For my mental health, I was never a Lions fan. And it's crazy because my husband's a huge Lions fan. He was at the Cowboys game, by the way.
He busted their ass on Sunday. Busted their ass, Wood.
And, so my mother, as y'all know from reading the book, you know, she spent some time in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where I was, I think, conceived. Okay. And so because of that, she liked the 49ers. And mm-hmm. so, you know, she would root for the Lions and for the 49ers. She really liked Joe Montana. That was, like, one of her favorite players. And so I just, you know, they were winning. You know?
Went with that team.
Why would you not go with the winning team, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, granted, you grew up in South Carolina, so y'all didn't have your own NFL team. Mm-hmm. And a lot of black fans that were not in NFL cities were Cowboys fans, even some that were. Like, in D.C., you know, it's kind of a not-so- quiet secret, there's a lot of Cowboys fans in D.C., mm-hmm. right? And so, at any rate, so I just became a 49ers fan. I've been with him, ever since. But Robert Saleh was, like, a great coach for us. So I when he was going through that last year with the Jets, I was like, this dude about to show them. Because he gets players to buy in, certainly from a schematic standpoint. Like, he's a really good coach.
What about the Cowgirls? I mean, Cowboys. What are your thoughts on them?
Offense still looking a little rough, Char.
We do.
Look a little rough, but that defense, it's a championship level defense.
Yeah.
And this was the kind of defense I wish Tony Romo would have had. You know, that's no way a shot at Dak Prescott. But people like to, as you know, they like to hate on Tony Romo. Mm-hmm. But they forget that he had categorically some of the worst defenses in NFL history. And I was like, damn, if they'd have had this defense with him, y'all might have won a couple. But
they didn't.
The Giants got the second best record in the league. You know who beat them?
Yo, here we go. Y'all go through this.
No, I'm
sure on a daily basis.
I just want to make sure you know who beat the Giants, right?
The third best team?
Just letting you know. Just letting you know.
But I like the Cowboys, but you know I ain't picking them over the 49ers.
Hell no.
Right?
But you know we're going to the Super Bowl this year, though. Because defense wins championships.
We know. Yeah. Like, we know that in San Francisco. That's why we had to come to Dallas last year and give y'all a piece.
That is very true. That is very true.
Well, we appreciate you for joining
Go
us.
Go get Uphills yes, out right now.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate y'all.
Oh, and I just want to say one last thing about Jemele Hill. When I announced my show, she called me in the middle of the night from Portugal. You were in Portugal, right?
No, I wasn't in Portugal, but I was somewhere out of the country. Was I in France? Maybe I was in south of France hanging with this dude.
Oh, that might have been
that. Oh, that's what you said.
Was that before that? I don't remember.
Was here when she announced it.
Oh, yeah, you were here? Okay, so maybe I was, but I was gone.
She was gone. No, I went on the night, and she was like, I just want to say congratulations. I was like, that is so nice.
Yeah, no, Angela,
I appreciate
I'm really proud of you for doing your thing, and as I wrote in the note to you in the book, is that you, you know, the agency, you betting on yourself, like, that's very, not just admirable, but it's very inspiring for somebody like me who, throughout this season of my career, that's what I've done, is, like, bet on myself. So I love seeing other women do, you know, the same thing.
Well, Jemele, thank
can you.
I appreciate
it. Listen.
Y'all, get off my girl.
Let me tell you something. I was late. Envy was stressed because he had to do my job.
Because she was late this morning. And this is what they do.
But I'm you like, want me to leave?
Go.
I didn't show up.
Thank you,
Go
guys.
Get Uphill. Jemele Hill. Her memoir's out right now.
That's right. I'm trying to be a bestseller, y'all.
There we go. Breakfast Club. Good morning.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
AT&T connects an ode to podcast. Connect the alarm, change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.